It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about GMW bees, or to give them their full name, Guaranteed Minimum Withdrawal Benefits. Is the speaker on? Can you hear me at the back? So the work I'm going to speak about is actually joint work and work in progress with a number of people. Moshe and I wrote a paper that appeared this year in Insurance Mathematics and Economics on financial valuation of GMWBs. This was work done when these were new riders that were being analyzed for the first time. Working paper with Moshe on asset allocation and transition to income. I should acknowledge that this work was partly funded by Manulife Corporation. That's an IFID working paper. It's available on the IFID website. Some ongoing work with Moshe and Huasheng Huang on asset allocation within GMWBs. So what's a GMWB? What's a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit? These are products that have been available in the United States for a number of years and have actually grown to be quite a sizable market there. Essentially, these are retirement savings vehicles. They're riders on a variable annuity contract. Those of you who have taught in the United States and have retirement savings with TIAA know all about variable annuity contracts. These are retirement savings plans whereby a certain portion of, well, one's contributions get allocated among a portfolio of different funds, so they are one's exposed to the equity markets in these plans. What's become quite popular lately is that these plans contain not simply basically a mutual fund, but as well a guarantee of some sort, either, for example, a death benefit that the value of the fund can fluctuate, but if one dies before one retires, one's beneficiaries are entitled to either the value of the investment or the initial amount that was put in, whichever is greater. And increasingly, these new kinds of benefits, the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits, whereby basically one is allowed to put money into this plan, invest it in the equity markets, and then basically be guaranteed that one can consume off that regardless of how badly the equity markets do. So in other words, so say one makes an initial deposit of some amount, W0, one is then allowed to withdraw from that account a fixed proportion of the initial investment every year, in this case, in that example, for a fixed period of time. Basically, one is guaranteed that one will be able to withdraw at least the amount one put in into the account, even if those draws coupled with market performance would actually drive the account value to zero. So in other words, if the markets do well, this account goes up in time, goes up over time, fine. One reaps the benefit of being exposed to the equity markets. But if, in fact, markets tank and one's retirement savings don't look so healthy, one is still allowed to withdraw as if one had one still had that lump of cash there sitting supporting one's consumption. So this is a way of allowing people to remain exposed to the equity markets, but also to be able to count on a certain level of consumption over time. And obviously what happens is that the firm selling the variable annuity with this rider steps in and makes good on the guarantee if, in fact, the account value is depleted. It's only one, as I mentioned, this is only one of several embedded options that one is increasingly finding in these investment vehicles, death benefits, ratchets, where the basis is stepped up if the markets do well, passport options, the ability to move funds and move the guarantee around between accounts, These have basically become rather complex products to value, and rather complex products to give investors advice about. Now, sort of before we get into why one might be interested in these things, let me complete some of the details about what how these things work. Obviously, one is often allowed to actually withdraw more than the guaranteed amount. In fact, one can lapse the VA, get out of it, and move to some other product at any time you like. Typically, to impose some drag on that, there are deferred surrender charges included in the product. Typically, the kind of withdrawals that are guaranteed aren't going to trigger deferred surrender charges. Usually, those charges are imposed if the withdrawal rate goes over what the guaranteed level is. And typically, in addition to triggering charges, that would trigger some reevaluation of the basis on which the guaranteed amount is made, or the period for which the guarantee is offered. And to continue in this vein, one of the things that one is finding much more commonly now than was the case when these products were first issued, one sees riders that include guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits for life. In other words, it's not simply the case that one is guaranteed to be able to withdraw one's initial deposit if the markets do badly, but that in fact these things will act in some ways like an annuity, in that one is eligible to withdraw a certain percentage of the basis every year one is alive. This product with the GMWB for Life Rider basically looks like a mutual fund if markets do well, and if markets do badly, it looks like an annuity. That has turned out to be quite a popular thing, naturally enough, given that these are viewed as retirement savings products. How are they paid for? Well, they're paid for by yearly fees either written on the account value or written on the amount that's guaranteed. In other words, people don't pay for these things up front. They pay for them over time. They pay for them by an annual debit on the account. There's, of course, a trade-off here. The more one charges in fees, the more likely it is that, in fact, the account will be depleted and the guarantee needs to be paid off. And, in fact, one can fairly easily see that high levels of fees simply are not economically sustainable. So there is some balance required into what the actual levels of fees are. These are complex products to value. There are typically a number of embedded options that interact with each other. There's optionality because people can opt to withdraw at any time, take the money out, to lapse the product, in which case, of course, one stops paying fees. The company issuing these cannot simply go and buy a put option in order to hedge these things and then count on the fees coming in year after year after year to pay for the put option. If people lapse and one is locked in some hedging strategy, then one is stuck paying for that even when the income meant to sustain that has gone away. So there are actually interesting hedging issues, interesting risk management issues, and interesting portfolio optimization issues associated with these products. I should add that one of the reasons they've been particularly popular in the United States is that they're tax-sheltered retirement savings plans. Some of the guarantees have been present in Canada for a long time. For example, most seg funds, segregated mutual funds, have a death benefit, so in that sense they share a similarity with variable annuities. But the Canadian products don't have the favorable tax treatment that one runs into the United States. These actually form a huge market in the U.S. There's about a trillion At the end of 2004, there was about $1 trillion in face value of these products, with a fairly high percentage, sort of around half of them, actually containing these GNWB riders or things related to them. So, in fact, these are things that many, many people own. They've been very popular. Why? Why has this segment of the market emerged? Why has it become something that many people have been interested in investigating? Well, that tells you part of the reason why. Traditionally, the reason that traditionally people counted on company pension plans, on the pension plan offered by people's employers, typically a defined benefit plan where one had a predictable income in retirement that one could figure out, one could usually figure out according to some formula. So traditionally people have relied on that kind of retirement savings, which in fact did offer a predictable income stream in order to support consumption in retirement. In the presence of an extensive set of such defined benefit pension plans, these things might not be as appealing as they have been. But what we've actually seen over the last few years is an increasing trend in which companies get out of the business of maintaining these traditional defined benefit pension plans, and in fact moving employees over to defined contribution plans. A defined contribution plan, of course, is one in which one's contributions are predictable. One is contributing a certain percentage of income, but that those contributions then get invested, and it's the performance of the investments that actually dictate how one is going to the income one is going to be able to draw on in retirement. There's been a real trend away from defined benefit plans and into defined contribution plans, essentially a trend in which companies have been transferring some of this retirement risk to employees. If you look at figures in Canada, in 1980, you had an extremely high percentage of firms offering defined benefit plans. Essentially, 94% of plans were defined benefit, a relatively small number being defined contribution plans. That's changed over time. The numbers have dropped to roughly 80% for DB plans, and the number of DC plans has gone up really significantly, and this trend continues. So one of the reasons that these products have become popular is exactly because more and more people are being left to their own devices in terms of planning for retirement. That with the erosion of defined benefit plans, the kind of income protection offered by these riders has been increasingly popular. There are reasons that firms have wanted to transfer this risk to individuals. We'll talk about a few of those in a second, but of course this means, this trend means therefore that individuals have to be cognizant of these risks and think about these risks. Risks such as improving mortality. One of the reasons firms have found DB plans to be rather expensive is exactly because mortality has been improving over the years. If one moves to DC, one doesn't have to worry about that anymore, but somebody does, and that somebody is you and me. The risk of improving mortality leaving us living longer than we had anticipated and possibly outliving our money and running out of money in retirement becomes something that people have to pay serious attention to. Just to give you an idea of what the mortality improvement has been, here's the range of life expectancy at birth. There's a male curve, there's a female curve. Those curves have been narrowing. Both have been going up over time from, I don't know if you can read the numbers, from 1926 to 1997. There's been major improvement, but it's improvement that continues for both genders. And in fact, it's sort of odd to talk about this as being a risk, but the risk is we're actually going to live longer than our parents did. The risk of outliving one's money is real. Again, Canadian figures. There is a substantial probability that those figures before were mortality, were life expectancies at birth. Of course, if you're 65, your life expectancy is much higher than it was at birth, if you survive to age 65. A 65-year-old Canadian stands at a 65 Canadian male stands over a 50% chance of living till age 80. For Canadian females, it's not until age 85 that one gets into the range of numbers of like 50%. But even at age 90, in both sexes, the numbers are still significant. And if one is a couple, in which the retirement savings are supposed to last until while at least one of them is alive, the numbers are even higher. So there really is a substantial probability that people will live a long time, and they have to plan for the possibility that they could in fact outlive their savings. If you look at the plan run by the federal government, and you look at beneficiaries of the Canada Pension Plan, you see that in fact there's a shift over time. The numbers are going up. Partly that's demographics, but also partly it's because of improving mortality. Typically these savings plans are looked at in the accumulation phase, and I just want to distinguish between the two periods in which one is interesting in analyzing these things. There's an accumulation phase while you're putting into the plan. There's the payout phase when you're taking out of it. And these products are really quite really most appealing, not so much when one's really young. One doesn't want to draw on retirement savings when one is earning employment income at a rapid rate. But as one starts reaching the period of time at which one's assets, one's savings are peaking, these kinds of products have become increasingly popular as a way of supporting income in the pay down phase. I think this slide is going to load. Okay, so what you're not seeing there, are some simulations of what would happen if one was withdrawing from a retirement savings plan at a particular rate. Yeah. I have to push it again. Oh, okay, they're going to load one at a time. So what we've done here, rather than just looking at a Monte Carlo study, is sort of look at historical returns and look at historical returns with different withdrawal rates. So the first, one imagines that one has $100 and that one is kind of going back in time, that as one looks, just to give you something to focus on, looking back in time, if we sort of had the same returns over, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, as we did a year in the past, 2 years in the past, 3 years in the past, well, we simply to invest in the fund and withdraw at a particular rate, one's interested in when, if you had $100 now and you were sort of living backwards in time, when you'd actually run out of money. So if you were withdrawing at $4 a year, sort of 4% of your initial deposit, using those historical returns, one in fact wouldn't run out of money. One would be quite fine. one withdraws at $5 a year and one looks at historical returns in the Canadian market, one would also do pretty fine. One would be going back to 1959. On the order of 44 years of retirement income, that should be enough for everybody. Well, that's withdrawing 5% a year. What if one withdrew 6% a year? Well, now things don't look quite so nice. Now one runs out of money in 1975. That is starting to look a little worrisome. I haven't increased the consumption rate all that much, but there it is at 7%, roughly what 15 years worth of money would last at if you simply put it in a mattress. Now one's running out of money in the mid-1980s, and at 8% it gets worse, 9%. It's a real issue. This is supposed to be tantalizing. Of course, Nortel is in there as well, so maybe it's cheating a bit, but whatever. The issue is real, that at modest rates of withdrawal, a pension plan, retirement savings can actually be depleted relatively rapidly. I think I'm going to speed up here a little bit. Again, probability of retirement ruin. Here we've looked at inflation-adjusted spending, $100 initial nest egg. This is with real Monte Carlo simulations, not with the kind of historical thing I had on the previous slide. Again, one is retiring at age 65. What's the probability that you'll actually run out of money before death? The numbers here have been kind of color-coded. Red are numbers above 20%, and in some ranges, in fact, these are numbers on the order of 30%. Yellow, not as bad as red, numbers between 10 and 20% of retirement ruin. Green, what one would certainly see as better, are numbers below 10%. Again, what one is looking at, one is looking at certain withdrawal rates in percentage terms per year across the top. Down this side, one is looking at asset allocations between equity and bonds. And what you'll, if there's a qualitative conclusion to be drawn here, it's that a diversified portfolio, something in the middle, actually does perform better in terms of protecting one against the risk of running out of money than either a very safe portfolio like one that is entirely in bonds or one that's particularly exposed to equity. And then one can ask the same kind of question about sensitivity to poor returns, particularly sensitivity to poor returns right at the point where one starts withdrawing one's retirement savings. Again, on the top here we have various different withdrawal rates. Here we have probability of ruin. Here we have a situation where one is 100% invested in equity. And what's going down here is the idea that one's sensitivity to poor returns, in fact, at the point where one starts withdrawing from the account, the effect of poor returns is particularly significant. People who retired in the year 2000 and started drawing on their retirement funds exactly at the point where returns were rather poor had a much higher would have had a much higher probability of ruin than people who had some initial good years and then in a subsequent five-year period experienced negative returns. Okay, so what's my point? My point is there are a whole bunch of planning issues around retirement, issues like longevity risk, issues like exposure to poor returns right at the beginning of the point at one starts, at which one starts withdrawing from one's retirement savings. Those risks are now being faced by individuals rather than being covered by the provider of a DB pension plan. Part of the reason that these products have proved so popular in the United States, part of the reason that this market has grown is exactly because, or one is plausible that it's exactly because individuals are now exposed to these risks. GMWBs are one way, the reason they exist, and especially GMWBs for life, they exist exactly because people want to manage this risk. They've been very popular in the United States. Products very much like this are available in Japan and the UK as well. And they're now starting to come to Canada. If you've looked at Maclean's magazine or a number of other places, you'll have seen ads for Manulife's new product, Income Plus. It's pretty much the first GMWB to be offered in Canada. I don't expect it to be the last. Okay, so let's turn to some mathematics. What are the mathematical questions? What are the quantitative questions that one would like to ask about these riders? Questions like, you know, what is a fair level of fee? What kinds of fees will actually allow these things to be hedged? What are the risk management issues associated with them? What are the asset allocation issues associated with these products? So in the IME paper, we looked at a couple of issues to do with, related to GMWBs sort of in almost the simplest case. Fixed period, the guarantee is going to be in place for a fixed period of time. One wants to get some idea of what the hedging cost associated with these products is. What do companies need to be charging in the way of yearly fees, and then reinvesting, or more, let me say that more carefully, what do companies need to charge and then reinvest in a hedge in order to be able to support these guarantees? You can analyze this a number of ways. Well, you can analyze this statically. You can just imagine that people are going to exercise their guarantees year after year after year, in which case this basically becomes kind of a European option embedded in one of these contracts. One can try and relate the pricing of this to sort of kinds of things that one finds firms dealing with on a regular basis when it comes to hedging European options. In this case, the European way of analyzing this was basically as a kind of Asian put, but written on a different basis. We called it a quanto Asian put. And one could basically use the methodology of Asian options to write down what a hedging strategy for the static problem, the problem where one basically is going to assume a certain kind of policyholder behavior, namely they're going to hold these things and withdraw the guaranteed amount. If you do that analysis, you find the following kinds of numbers coming out. If you've got a withdrawal rate of about 4%, you find that the cost, the yearly cost, the charge, the insurance charge that should be deducted from the account and then applied to hedging, not going off for marketing or for trailers or other things, but actually applied to hedging, being in the range of 23 to 60 basis points. And for a higher withdrawal rate, for example, a withdrawal rate is 7% per year, one's looking at cost in basis points of, you know, something on the order of 73 basis points, 80 basis points, something like that. So these are not cheap things to, these are not actually cheap riders to sell and hedge, even in the static case. What about in the dynamic case, where one throws optionality in, where one throws in the possibility of investors doing things, lapsing the products that affects one's ability to hedge these things? One can't simply imagine that they're annuities because any day investors can come and ask for their money back. On the other hand, one has to deal with the possibility of markets dropping and leaving the issuer holding the guarantee. So simplest analysis one could do, look at an account value. There's a risk neutrally, there's going to be a rate of return R minus alpha because we're taking fees out. There's going to be a deduction from the account value, gamma of T, because of withdrawals. And one will be tracking not just the account value, but also the guarantee level. So as when withdraws from the account, one also withdraws from the total amount that is left to be paid out, that is guaranteed to be left to be paid out over time. And as long as the amount one withdraws is less than the amount that one is guaranteed to be able to withdraw, that's going to be the expression that reflects how the guarantee evolves. So in this kind of model, what's optimal behavior going to be? So in this model, there are no resets. There's no ratchet provision, basically. Imagine the situation. Say the market does really well. Well, you then have this guarantee that's written at the initial amount you bought into the product for. You're paying relatively hefty fees, alpha, over time for this. If the markets have done really well, and if the account value has significantly gone up, your guarantee isn't actually all that impressive. Your account value is much bigger than that. Why should you continue to pay for it? So if the account value actually gets high enough, it's clear that optimal behavior is to lapse the thing, pay the deferred surrender charge if need be, and then repurchase the product, establishing the guarantee at a high level. And what makes these products the way we are going to analyze these products is that basically both kinds of fees that are collected, either the fees, the sort of regular fees, deducted from the account value, or the deferred surrender charges, if one opts to lap, get reinvested in the hedge, and that gives us basically the an expression for how for what the account holder receives as a result of making withdrawals from the account. As I said, we assume that the seller is hedging using both the insurance charge and the deferred surrender charge. In the initial analysis anyway, we also assume that the seller wants to be perfectly hedged, so hedged regardless of what kind of lapsation behavior they run into. In that case, it really is basically an American option, with the behavior being basically either to withdraw the guaranteed amount or essentially to lapse the account. That's what turns out to be optimal. One can derive a PDE for the hedging value. It's going to be a free boundary problem with corresponding to at what level it's optimal to lapse this thing. And you can solve the PDE numerically by standard techniques. Basically, so to get the picture here, let's fix levels of fees. Let's imagine in this problem here that we fixed the level of fee alpha, we fixed the level of fee kappa, and by solving the American option problem, by solving the free boundary problem, what's one doing? One is figuring out what one would have to have on hand at any time in order to hedge the product. Let's move that back to time zero. One can calculate a hedging cost for this product, what it would cost to implement a perfect hedge, a hedge in which one is basically insured against any kind of behavior on the part of the policyholders. If in fact the hedging cost is more than the initial capital that's deposited with you, then in fact, what's that saying? That's saying the capital isn't enough to hedge. The company basically you make your deposit, the insurer, in fact, cannot implement the hedge with that initial amount. Whereas if the hedging cost is smaller than the amount initially deposited with the firm, then there's a clear profit to the seller. The question that we're actually interested in is, what are the appropriate levels of fees that actually make these two things equal? What are the appropriate levels of fees such that when someone comes in and deposits an initial amount, W0, that is in fact the appropriate amount to have on hand in order to implement the hedge? What we found when we looked at this, this was a number of years ago, was that in fact being underhedged is typical, which initially was rather strange. In other words, that the embedded options were being sold below cost. One doesn't usually get a deal like that, so we'll talk a little bit about why that might be the case. But for example, with a withdrawal of 7% per year, with a risk-free rate of 5%, volatility of 20%, and a deferred surrender charge of 1%, if you work out what the critical level of fees are, the level of fees alpha at which this product will be hedged based on the initial deposit, you get a rather high level. You get about 160 basis points. Whereas in fact, what one was seeing in the market at the time was an alpha of roughly 30 to 50 basis points for that kind of withdrawal rate. I should add that one thing we've seen happen since that initial analysis was done was that a lot of these withdrawal rates have gone down. Many of the newer riders that have been written actually have a lower withdrawal rate than that, which one can imagine is in part attributable to trying to make these things more sustainable. But how can firms afford to do this? How can firms afford to sell these riders below cost? Well, partly it's because these fee levels have been calculated basically assuming worst case behavior on the part of unit holders. If one is willing to make other assumptions about the lapsation rate, if one is willing to make assumptions that people are not going to lapse in the way that is sort of optimal from a financial economic point of view, for example, that there are liquidity constraints that force people to lapse these things, are they going to lapse when the markets do badly, even though that's exactly when their guarantees are actually worth something. If one is willing to make those assumptions, then it stands to reason that a lower level of fees alpha should be sustainable. Just to look at what the kind of numbers we had, if you do a static pricing of these things, say at the 20% level, we saw before we had about 73 basis points. If one then takes the possibility of adverse behavior on the part of unit holders into account, one gets significantly high fee levels. I think in the interest of time, I'll skip over the derivation of Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman. But suffice it to say that what one is doing, remember that the value function one was solving for was essentially a function of two variables, a function of what the account value was and a function of what the guarantee level was. And one can derive a parabolic PDE in those two variables. One can derive Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman, and that's where the computation of those numbers came from. It's perhaps worth pointing out that the PDE one gets is very similar to what one would expect from the point of view of American options, the one wrinkle being that the variable that's playing the role of time isn't actually time anymore, it's the account value. So if one thinks of the account value as being some proxy for time in the mathematics, one is ending up with a mathematical problem that is quite standard and can be handled quite well using existing techniques. Couple of further points. The main takeaway from the analysis was that these things were underpriced. Talking to actuaries in firms that were supporting this, this in fact resonated. Many actuaries were actually worried about these things being underpriced, but that fee levels had been set for other reasons other than a complete actuarial evaluation. So this was a finding that resonated in that setting. As I said, one can, if one is willing to make assumptions about lapsation rates, one can imagine sustainable fees being set at some lower level. However, that's an issue that's actually attracted some attention. The IME paper actually got some attention from Moody's, who in a special comment they wrote in October 2005 warned about the risks that companies were in fact bearing because of this underpricing of the guarantees. Moody's basically said that many companies in fact realize that policyholder inefficiency is a key driver of the pricing of these guarantees. And Moody's also warned that increased efficiency in the markets is only a matter of time. That as time goes on, and as other players start getting interested in the variable annuity market, relying on policyholder inefficiencies is kind of a risky thing. And it's essential for insurance companies to actually pay careful attention to the possibility of arbitraging actuarial assumptions like irrational lapsation. Just to give you an example of groups like Coventry, which have traditionally worked in the area of trying to arbitrage life insurance contracts, have made the move into looking at GMWBs, more generally at guarantees embedded in VA contracts and trying to arbitrage them. Okay, so that was the analysis that was done a few years ago. What's more recent? What are the issues that are being looked at? Things that have been looked at more recently, or what is the work that's going on in this area? Well, one thing that's happened is that sort of takes away some of the concerns around policyholder behavior are sort of the emergence of ratchets in these products, that the guarantee basically ratchets up over time as the account value goes up. And basically that removes this feature that if the account goes up, it's optimal to lapse the thing. The point being that the company, to avoid people lapsing, resets the basis for the guarantee. One can model that fairly easily. One can base withdrawals on the maximum observed account value rather than on the current account value. And again, one can compute hedging costs under those circumstances. They're still expensive. One can do things that are that really do involve actuarial that really are more actuarial in nature than simply the GMWB for a fixed term. And there are a whole bunch of interesting issues that come up if one tries to do that. So analyzing GMWBs for life, now the guaranteed withdrawals persist for the lifetime of the policyholder as long as they don't lapse the product. And one can start trying to analyze some of the risk management issues in that context. One can imagine that one sells a lot of these and analyze this from the firm point of view, basically assuming that mortality is fully diversified. Or conversely, one can start looking at things that could be done with mortality risk retained, in which it's not possible to do a perfect hedge. There's a lot of interesting work on hedging in incomplete markets, which would be the situation with the mortality risk still present. For example, quantile hedging and various other things. One can look at these questions in that context. One can try looking at the full products rather than simply looking at the riders one at a time. The full product is actually extremely complex, and valuing them analytically probably is not feasible, in which case one would turn to other techniques altogether. What we're currently interested in particularly is optimal policy behavior. In the presence of mortality, so in the presence of guarantees, GMWBs for life, guarantees that persist for the lifetime of the policyholder, it certainly isn't a two-way market. One, at least as of today, one can't buy and sell. The presence of mortality basically introduces an incompleteness in the market, particularly as far as the individual goes. Whereas the firm may be able to hedge against mortality risk by selling a large number of contracts, you don't have a way of hedging your mortality risk unless you bring products like insurance or annuities into the mix as well, and that's certainly something one can look at. But simply from the point of view of analyzing this kind of product, one can look at behavior which is utility maximizing for the purchaser, seeing if in the presence of this incompleteness that arises because of mortality, if one analyzes what's optimal from the point of view of maximizing policyholder utility, one gets actually different answers from the question of what's optimal from the point of view of simply eliminating risk on the part of the firm. A particularly interesting question is that of asset allocation within a portfolio of variable annuities protected by one of these guarantees. This is actually perfectly typical. If you buy a variable annuity, typically one has a whole host of funds that one can invest these things in. Very often it's the overall portfolio of investments that is protected by the rider rather than the positions in the individual funds. And of course, one can naturally ask questions about what is the best way to allocate assets within one of these retirement savings plans given the protection offered by the rider versus what would have been the optimal asset allocation in a fund that isn't protected by the guarantees. If you think about it, it's pretty clear that optimal behavior is going to get more aggressive. Essentially, in an unprotected portfolio, of course, one has a mixture of bonds and equities, and one is essentially using the presence of bonds as a kind of reserve or as a kind of insurance against the possibility that the market will go down. If the market goes down, you then move money from the bond position into the equity position as a way of smoothing things out. Also as a way of buying equities when they're cheap. But in any case, there's a sense in which the bond position is a kind of insurance against the equity position. Well, if one actually has insurance built in, if one has this kind of guarantee that is basically promising you that you will be able to consume at the desired level for an extended period of time, even if the markets do well, you can take on more equity risk. You don't have to be as conservative in making your asset allocation when one of these riders is in effect as you do otherwise. And actually trying to understand that is an issue that many firms are, and regulators as well, are actually quite interested in looking at. So this is a particularly current topic right at the moment. In fact, if the utility of consumption is all you care about, we actually had very great difficulty finding ranges of parameters in which the optimal behavior wasn't to go and get leveraged by a factor of about 600% in your retirement savings plan. So in other words, to really borrow heavily against the guarantee and buy equities. Of course, you can't actually do this. You can't actually achieve leverage within one of these portfolios, but the simple message from that analysis is that if it is utility of consumption you care about, utility of consumption with the possibility of benefiting from upswings in the equity markets in terms of, say, resetting your guarantees at a higher level, then use the optimal behavior is actually to grab as much equity and to grab as much risk within the plan as possible. And in fact, one sees some of this. One sees in data that in VA plans that are protected by these things, the allocation to, for example, larger mid-cap equities changes from being below 50% to being above 60%. It's not a huge change, but it's a significant change. And in fact, our analysis suggests that if utility of consumption was all one cared about, one should see a much, much bigger change than that, and one should see, in fact, small caps or other asset classes getting picked up to more of an extent than we actually see. So obviously, utility of consumption isn't the only issue. One of the reasons people would buy these things in preference to, for example, simply buying an annuity is that they do want to preserve some liquidity, they do want to preserve some capital, they want that money to be there if either for their beneficiaries or if they have a liquidity crunch and they need to draw on that money somehow. And one of the things we're currently working on is trying to model find an appropriate model for the utility of people who are sort of blending both liquidity and consumption, trying to look at data and try and figure out what kinds of utility functions people who are buying these products are achieving, and sort of to develop some way of saying, you know, under what circumstances, for what kinds of individuals, are these kinds of products a reasonable alternative to consider. So that's basically what I wanted to say. In closing, I should acknowledge prior literature or give you other sources to look at that if you want to look into some related issues. Of course, there are the seminal papers in this whole area of equity-linked insurance and guarantees on portfolio of Brennan and Schwartz in 1976 and Boyle and Schwartz a year later. Other approaches to other applications of Asian option pricing related to this, you can see Malevsky and Poser. There's a variety of work on variable annuities, Brown and Perturba, Boyle and his co-authors. That one is particularly relevant to this work in that what Phelim and his co-authors were doing was actually trying to model how lapsation takes place as a way of, because that's an important part of how pricing is actually going to work. If you want a monograph treatment of these kinds of actuarial investment guarantees, there's Mary Hardy's book in 2003. And that concludes what I want to say. Thank you very much for your attention.